Welcome, everybody, to the Untold History Channel. It is Monday, the 27th of January. Days just run together for me. I really, it's like, I don't even hardly remember what days are which. So, but today is the 27th of January. Hard to believe it's almost February. Crazy. And, but it is Monday night, which means that it is the time, our time with the infamous ghost. And tonight, guys, we're going to do something a little bit different. It's not going to be a watch party, but it's going to, we're going to play and react to the Trump address at the World Economic Forum, which, if you guys have not seen, absolute pure gold. And now I'm just going to warn you to get through it a little bit faster. I'm not going to play at a regular speed. I'm going to play it at 1.5 speed. So it may be, you know, but you guys will get the gist. So, and it'll give us something to talk about so that we can actually pause it and discuss and get through everything. And then there's going to be a couple of other videos that are about 10 minutes long. Same situation where they're talking about, you know, what would happen if we went to war with the cartels and things of that nature, and their contrary opinions, which I always enjoy hearing. We'll address that when we get to it. So, but first of all, Ghost, how are you this evening?
I am just fine. How about yourself?
I can't complain. I made a lot of progress the last couple of days on my office or on my studio, getting some lights and stuff put up, and I went back to my green screen just because it's a lot nicer looking, at least temporarily. But I'm really eager to get my studio going, and when it's so intricate, and I'm doing it all by myself. And, you know, all my books, you see the books behind me, that's like an eighth of the books that I have. So it's just, I've got a lot of stuff to do, soundproof the room. It's just, there's a lot to do. So it's not as easy as just, and I don't have any, I'm not hiring anybody to come in and do it. So, you know, when you do it by yourself, it just takes longer. So, anyway. That said, let's get into this, because I'm actually eager to jump into this. This is going to be fantastic. All right, here we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
Well, thank you very much, Klaus, and hello to everyone in beautiful Davos. This has been a truly historic week in the United States.
I want to pause it for a second here, because I want you to look at something. Look at the eagle behind Trump, not the one on the podium, but the one behind him. Look at the head of the eagle, which way it's facing.
And what's at the claw?
It's facing towards the arrows, not the olive branch.
Where the seal is facing the olive branches.
Right. And why does
things like this mean a great deal?
Why does the head face the olive branch instead of the arrows?
Because peace should be our primary intent.
Because it's about peace. We want peace, but on this particular image, the head of the eagle is facing the arrows, meaning war. Thought that was a very interesting thing.
Meaning we'll whoop your ass if you want to play games.
Right. Yeah. But I thought that was that's a huge calm that I haven't heard anybody talk about.
Yeah, and it is. It's much more significant than meets the eye.
Right. So,
I took the oath of office and we began the golden age of America. The recent presidential election was won by millions of votes and all seven, every one of them, all seven swing states. It was a massive mandate from the American people like hasn't been seen in many years. And some of the political pundits, even some of my so-called enemies, said it was the most consequential election victory in 129 years. That's quite nice. What the world has witnessed in the past 72 hours is nothing less than a revolution of common sense. Our country will soon be stronger, wealthier, and more united than ever before, and the entire planet will be more peaceful and prosperous as a result of this incredible momentum and what we're doing and going to do. My administration is acting with unprecedented speed to fix the disasters we've inherited from a totally inept group of people and to solve every single crisis facing our country. This begins with confronting the economic chaos caused by the failed policies of the last administration. Over the past 4 years, our government racked up $8 trillion in wasteful deficit spending and inflicted nation-wrecking energy restrictions, crippling regulations, and hidden taxes like never before. The result is the worst inflation crisis in modern history and sky-high interest rates for our citizens and even throughout the world. Food prices and the price of almost every other thing known to mankind went through the roof. President Biden totally lost control of what was going on in our country, but in particular with our high inflation economy and at our border. Because of these ruinous policies, total government spending this year is $1.5 trillion higher than was projected to occur when I left office just 4 years ago.
So I'm going to pause it there for a second. He basically, yes, guys, this is not a two speed. It's a 1.5 speed. And I'm doing that because I want to get through it fast and talk about it. You guys will get if you haven't seen it, you can go back and watch it yourself. But you'll get at least get the gist of what he's saying. Basically, everything that he just said right there is Biden's policies are all of the policies of the people at Davos. And he's just freaking throwing it right in their face. Your thoughts? Oh, you've got.
He's buttering them up to smear it in their faces.
Oh yeah, no, he's buttering. He's. I'm not going to be that vulgar, but he's buttering. He's not buttering up their face.
Yeah.
Likewise, the cost of servicing the debt is more than 230% higher than was projected in 2020. The inflation rate we are inheriting remains 50% higher than the historic target. It was the highest inflation probably in the history of our country. That's why from the moment I took office, I've taken rapid action to reverse each and every one of these radical left policies that created this calamity, in particular with immigration, crime, and inflation. On day one, I signed an executive order directing every member of my cabinet to marshal all powers at their disposal to defeat inflation and reduce the cost of daily life. I imposed a federal hiring freeze, a federal regulation freeze, a foreign aid freeze, and I created the new Department of Government Efficiency. I terminated the ridiculous and incredibly wasteful Green New Deal. I call it the Green New Scam. Withdrew from the one-sided Paris.
The Green New Scam. Throwing it, again, right in their face. Your freaking, your climate bullshit is not going to last in the United States. And one thing that I noticed is that when he started off is like how he won in a landslide fashion, and we all know it was even greater than what they said it was, yeah. But he's essentially telling them, look, all of the people, the country is behind me, and so it don't matter what you say, you're done. Because the people are behind me, and we are a freight train coming down the tracks, and there's nothing you can do to stop it.
Yep.
So, yeah, you can think for yourself here too, bro.
Oh no, I'll save everything for afterwards.
Okay, I'm just giving you shit.
The meat and taters.
Climate Accord and ended the insane and costly electric vehicle mandate. We're going to let people buy the car they want to buy. I declared a national energy emergency, and it's so important, national energy emergency to unlock the liquid gold under our feet and pave the way for rapid approvals of new energy infrastructure. The United States has the largest amount of oil and gas of any country on earth, and we're going to use it. Not only will this reduce the cost of virtually all goods and services, it'll make the United States a manufacturing superpower and the world capital of artificial intelligence and crypto. My administration has also begun the largest deregulation campaign in history, far exceeding even the record-setting efforts of my last term. In total, the Biden administration imposed $50,000 in additional regulatory costs on the average American household over the last 4 years. I have promised to eliminate 10 old regulations for every new regulation, which will soon put many thousands of dollars back in the pockets of American families. to further unleash our economy, our majorities in the House and Senate, which we also took along with the presidency, are going to pass the largest tax cut in American history, including massive tax cuts for workers and family and big tax cuts for domestic producers and manufacturers. And we're working with the Democrats on getting an extension of the original Trump tax cuts, as you probably know, by just reading any paper. My message to every business in the world is very simple. Come make your product in America, and we will give you among the lowest taxes of any nation on earth. We're bringing them down very substantially, even from the original Trump tax cuts. But if you don't make your product in America, which is your prerogative, then very simply, you will have to pay a tariff, differing amounts, but a tariff which will direct hundreds of billions of dollars and even trillions of dollars into our treasury to strengthen our economy and pay down debt. Under the Trump administration, there will be no better place on earth to create jobs, build factories, or grow a company than right here in the good old USA. Already Americans, economic, and you can see this, I think, maybe even in your wonderful, wonderful room that you're all gathered together, so many of my friends, but Americans, the economic confidence is soaring like we haven't seen in many, many decades, maybe not at all. Upon my election, it was just announced that small business optimism skyrocketed by 41 points in a single month. That's the highest ever. There's never been anything like that. SoftBank has announced between a $100 and $200 billion investment in the U.S. economy because of the election result. And just 2 days ago, Oracle, SoftBank, and OpenAI announced a $500 billion investment in AI infrastructure. Other companies likewise have announced billions and billions and billions, adding up to trillions of investment in America and the United States. And it's also reported today in the papers that Saudi Arabia will be investing at least $600 billion in America. But I'll be asking the Crown Prince, who's a fantastic guy, to round it out to around $1 trillion. I think they'll do that because we've been very good to them. And I'm also going to ask Saudi Arabia and OPEC to bring down the cost of oil. You got to bring it down, which, frankly, I'm surprised they didn't do before the election. That didn't show a lot of love by them not doing it. I was a little surprised by that. If the price came down, the Russia-Ukraine war would end immediately. Right now, the price is high enough that that war will continue. You got to bring down the oil price. You got to end that war. They should have done it long ago. They're very responsible, actually, to a certain extent for what's taking place. Millions of lives are being lost. With oil prices going down, I'll demand that interest rates drop immediately. And likewise, they should be dropping all over the world. Interest rates should follow us. All over the progress that you're seeing is happening because of our historic victory in a recent presidential election.
Hey, again, he's I'm going to say it again because there's new people coming in. I'm speeding this up to get through it faster so that we're not just this. I want to watch Trump's speech for the sake of watching Trump's speech. It's 1.5 speed to get through it faster. If you guys want to watch it on your own, you can go watch it on your own, but this is we just want to get through this. So Esty Gardner said that the Malay speech was even better than Trump's speech. And to that, I actually agree, because he just was throwing that woke bullshit right back into their face. Maybe that would be another good one to go over, because, wow, that was awesome. But anyway, I'm going to let it just continue here because I want to get through this.
One that has become quite well known throughout the world. I think a lot of things are happening to a lot of countries. They say that there's light shining all over the world since the election, and even countries that we aren't particularly friendly with are happy because they understand what there is a future and how great the future will be under our leadership. America is back and open for business. And this week, I'm also taking swift action to stop the invasion at our southern border. They allowed people to come in at levels that nobody's ever seen before. It was ridiculous. I decided and declared to do, and very, very importantly, a national emergency on our border, immediately halted all entry of illegal border crossers, of which there were many, and began promptly returning the illegal trespassers back to the place from which they came. That action, as you've probably seen, has already started very strongly. I've deployed active duty U.S. military and National Guard troops to the border to assist in repelling the invasion. It was really an invasion. We will not allow our territory to be violated. After 4 long years, the United States is strong and sovereign and a beautiful nation. Once again, it's a strong, sovereign nation. In addition, I'm pleased to report that America is also a free nation once again. On day one, I signed an executive order to stop all government censorship. No longer will our government label the speech of our own citizens as misinformation or disinformation, which are the favorite words of censors and those who wish to stop the free exchange of ideas and, frankly, progress. We have saved free speech in America, and we've saved it strongly. With another historic executive order this week, I also ended the weaponization of law enforcement against the American people and, frankly, against politicians, and restored the fair, equal, and impartial rule of law. My administration has taken action to abolish all discriminatory diversity, equity, and inclusion nonsense, and these are policies that were absolute nonsense throughout the government and the private sector. With the recent yet somewhat unexpected great Supreme Court decision just made, America will once again become a merit-based country. You have to hear that word, merit-based country. And I've made it official, an official policy of the United States, that there are only two genders, male and female. And we will have no men participating in women's sports, and transgender operations, which became the rage, will occur very rarely. Finally, as we restore common sense in America, we're moving quickly to bring back strength and peace and stability abroad. I'm also going to ask all NATO nations to increase defense spending to 5% of GDP, which is what it should have been years ago. It was only at 2%, and most nations didn't pay until I came along. I insisted that they pay, and they did, because the United States was really paying the difference at that time, and it was unfair to the United States. But many, many things have been unfair for many years to the United States. Before even taking office, my team negotiated a ceasefire agreement in the Middle East, which wouldn't have happened without us, as I think most of the people in the room know. Earlier this week, the hostages began to return to their families. They are returning, and it's a beautiful sight, and they'll be coming in more and more. They started coming back on Sunday. Our efforts to secure a peace settlement between Russia and Ukraine are now hopefully underway. It's so important to get that done. That is an absolute killing field. Millions of soldiers are being killed, and nobody's seen anything like it since World War II. They're laying dead all over the flat fields. It's a flat field farmland, and there's millions of Russians and millions of Ukrainians, and nobody's seen anything like it since World War II. It's time to end it. And here in America, we have big events coming up. Next year, we have the 250th anniversary of America's founding. I'm so honored to be president during that. That's been a big event. They've been talking about it for 10 years. We also have the World Cup. And I understand Gianni's in the room. Infantino, he was very instrumental in helping us get it. He's there with you someplace, I think. And I want to thank him for that. And then we have the Olympics coming up, which I was instrumental in getting also in my first term. And who would have known that by skipping a term, I would get the Olympics? I was upset. I said, you know, I got the Olympics to come and I won't be president. But it turned out through a stroke of luck or whatever you might call it, that I'm going to be president during the World Cup and the Olympics and the 250th anniversary. So that's going to be three big events. And we've accomplished more in less than 4 days.
I want to say something about that. I didn't realize, but you know, that this 4D chess thing or 5D chess thing that he's done with getting the World Cup and the Olympics during his presidency and the 250th anniversary of the country. It's like he's going, this is going to be, it's going to stimulate growth. It's going to, and especially here in Southern California, because that's the Olympics are going to be in Los Angeles. So, I mean, it's going to be monstrous. It didn't even dawn on me that typically those two events are, in terms of worldwide, coming together, in competition sports and whatnot, those are big deals. And we get them both and within a short period of time. And that's not accidental, I don't believe.
No, I don't think so either. But
it works
well.
Yeah, absolutely.
4 days than other administrations have accomplished in 4 years. And we're just getting started. It's really an amazing thing to see. And the spirit and the light over our country has been incredible. Under the last administration, our nation has suffered greatly. But we're going to bring it back and make it greater, bigger, stronger, better than ever before. I want to thank everybody for being with you. I would have been there myself, except the inauguration was 2 days ago. I thought it might be a little bit quick to make it the first stop. But we'll get there one day. We hope to get there. But I do appreciate, I heard the audience is fantastic. And many of my friends are in the audience. And I will be taking questions now from some very distinguished people. Thank you all very much.
You can tell that the applause are very much an obligatory applause and not like a resounding, oh, that was awesome. It's like, yeah, they're applauding. they're applauding because it's like they're in the audience and not everybody is applauding, which I find hilarious. And now comes the fun part. Oh.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. President, for that very powerful speech. And I think you could hear the applause all the way from Davos to the White House. But next year it will be even better because then you can get the applause here in Davos. So we wish you welcome to our village next year. We hope to see you.
Thank you very much.
So we also know, Mr. President, that you open up for interaction here. We have a great panel with some of the most distinguished business people in the world. Let me start with someone that you know really well, that I think is almost a neighbor of you in Florida. Mr. Steve Schwarzman, Chairman, CEO, and co-founder of Blackstone Group. So Steve, floor is yours.
Well, Mr. President, I'm sure the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia will be really glad you gave this speech today. You've had the busiest 4 days that anybody can imagine, and congratulations for that. My question is about some of the things I've observed here at Davos. It's a terrific forum. I've met lots of people, as usual. I think I've been here 30 years. And a lot of the European business people have expressed enormous frustration with the regulatory regime in the EU. And they attribute slower growth rates here because of the numerous factors, but especially because of regulations. And you've taken a completely different approach in this area. And if you could explain the theory of what you're doing, how you're going to do it, and what you expect the outcome to be, I'd appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. And congratulations, Steve. You're a friend of mine, but on a great career. You've had an amazing career and continues. So I just want to congratulate you. Very inspirational to a lot of people. I want to talk about the EU, because you mentioned specifically that I've also had a lot of friends and leaders of countries. I've gotten to know them all my first term and a little bit during this period of 4 years, and know them well, like them a lot, but they're very frustrated because of the time everything seems to take to get approved, environmental impact statements for things that you shouldn't even have to do that, and many, many other ways that it takes. And I'm going to give you a quick little example. My beautiful private life, before I had all these things happening, the world is a little different. I had a nice, simple life. You knew that. But when I had that simple life, I did projects, and I had a big project in Ireland, and it had to get approval on something that would have made it even better. And I got the approval from Ireland in a period of a week. And it was a very, very, very efficient, good approval. And they informed me, though, the problem is you're going to have to get it from the EU. And we think that'll take 5 to 6 years. And I said, you have to be kidding. And this was before politics. And I said, wait a minute, it's not that important. I don't want to go 5 or 6 years, but it would have been a big investment. It would have been nice. And it would have been good for the project. And I sent the people to the EU to see if they could speed it up. And basically, it was a 5 or 6 year wait just to get a simple approval that Ireland gave me in a period of literally not much more than a week. And I realized right then, that was the first time I really was involved with the EU, but I realized right then that's a problem, and I didn't even bother applying to do it. And, or if I did, I pulled it very quickly. I have to be very accurate because I don't want to be criticized. He did apply, actually. No, I want to be very accurate. So I don't think I did, but if I did, I pulled it very quickly. It was just something you couldn't wait 5 years or 6 years to get an approval. So a lot of, in a very big business sense, a lot of people are claiming that's the problem. From the standpoint of America, the EU treats us very, very unfairly, very badly. They have a large tax that we know about, and a VAT tax, and it's a very substantial one. They don't take our farm products, and they don't take our cars, yet they send cars to us by the millions. They put tariffs on things that we want to do. Like, for instance, I think they actually, in terms of these are non-economic or non-monetary tariffs, and those are very bad, and they make it very difficult to bring products into Europe, and yet they expect to be selling, and they do sell their products in the United States. So we have, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of deficits with the EU, and nobody's happy with it, and we're going to do something about it, but nobody's happy with it. So I think the EU has to speed up their process. Friends of mine that are in some of the nations within the EU, great people, they want to be able to compete better, and you can't compete when you can't go through the approval process fast. There's no reason why it can't go faster. So, you know, I'm trying to be constructive because I love Europe. I love the countries of Europe, but the process is a very cumbersome one. And they do treat the United States of America very, very unfairly with the VAT taxes and all of the other taxes they impose. One other, just to finish up, I got a call from the head of a major airline, one of the biggest airlines in the world. And he said, sir, could you help us? What? Landing in Europe is brutal. They charge us fees for everything. And it's so unfair. I said, how does it compare to China? He said, it's much worse. And the other thing, as you know, they took court cases with Apple, and they supposedly won a case that most people didn't think was much of a case. They won 15 or 16 billion from Apple. They won billions from Google. I think they're after Facebook for billions and billions. These are American companies, whether you like them or not, they're American companies, and they shouldn't be doing that. And that's, as far as I'm concerned, it's a form of taxation. So we have some very big complaints with the EU. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and stop it there because, I mean, the rest of the speech is, I mean, I mean, how much of an ass whooping do we need to see? He kicked their ass, and that's the important thing. So let's talk a little bit about the speech, just kind of what he said to them and whatnot. Because that was just, I mean, again, ass whooping.
I think you should refer to them as the PU anyway, but that's just my humble opinion. but he's being nice, and you can see how he was saying, you know, of course, you know, I've got some friends in the audience and all this. He was saying that just, you know, to
tongue in cheek,
yeah, lighten it up, and also a little tongue in cheek there, because he's basically saying, you know, whether everyone in this room knows it or not, this organization represents part of a multifaceted covert front to infiltrate and weaken this country. And they do it through, and again, I'll mention, their greatest tool is bureaucracy. It is making things wait for inordinate amount of time, amounts of time before they're approved at one level, to only need approval at another or another or another. Mm-hmm. And with regard to this country, they've been taking advantage of it, of us, and they know it. As far as NATO and so many other things. So he's basically saying point blank, all this shitfuckery is going to end. It's already begun to end, and there's nothing you can do about it. So
they've been taking advantage of us, but it's actually worse than that. We have been bending over, and it's like, we are dropping the soap on purpose and bending over, allowing it to happen. Mm-hmm. They're just taking advantage of us, because it's like we're inviting them in.
And these businessmen who are supposedly his friends, give me a break. Mm-mm. They've been part of it.
1,000%.
He knows that. They know that. So he puts on a nice smile and says, you know, thank you, and, you know, whatever else, other nonsense that guy said, the American. And no, you've been part of it. And you haven't been quite as obvious because you're here, but you've been part of it just as much as they have. So, again, all these agreements mean nothing in the end if we're not being treated fairly. And he sees that, and he's pulling us out. And good riddance to them in Europe. Work it out. We have to work out our problems that are far more monumental than what you're dealing with over there. And, deal with it.
You know, Shelley actually was talking about the Malay speech. And I thought, you know what? It might not be a bad idea to listen to a little bit of that as well, because did you hear any of that?
No, I haven't. I've been tied up pretty much this week.
Let's do a little bit of that, because that's also really fun. Here we go. I won't do it so fast. I'll do it like 1.5 speed, or 1.25. Let's see here.
It's a great turnout for one of the highlights during our annual meeting. We will be joined by President Javier Milei. It's the second time at our.
He eviscerates them. This is fantastic.
Good morning, everyone. And how much has changed in such a short time? A year ago, I stood here before you alone and spoke some truths about the state of the Western world that were met with some surprise and astonishment by much of the political, economic, and media establishment of the West. And I must admit that in a way, I understand it. A president from a country that, as a result of systematic economic failure for more than 100 years, as a result of having the country taken weak stances in major global conflicts, and as a result of us having closed ourselves off to trade, we have lost practically all international significance over the years. A president of such a country stood on this stage and told the entire world that they were wrong, that they were headed for failure, that the West had gone astray, and that it needed to be redirected. The president of that country, Argentina, who was not a politician, who had no legislative support, no backing from governors, business leaders, or media groups. In that speech, here standing before you, I told you it was the beginning of a new Argentina, that Argentina had been infected with socialism for far too long, and that with us it would once again embrace the ideas of freedom, a model that we summarize as the defense of life, liberty, and private property. And I also told you that, in a way, Argentina was the ghost of Western Christmases yet to come, because we had already experienced everything you were going through, and we already knew how it would end. A year later, I must say that I no longer feel so alone. I don't feel alone because the world has embraced Argentina. Argentina has become a global example of fiscal responsibility, of commitment to honoring our obligations, and obviously a commitment to solve the inflation problem. Also, we are an example of a new way of doing politics, which is about telling people the truth to their faces and trusting that they will understand. Nor do I feel alone, because over the course of this year, I have found allies in this fight for the ideas of freedom in every corner of the world. From the amazing Elon Musk to that fierce Italian lady, my dear Giorgia Meloni, from Bukele in El Salvador to Viktor Orban in Hungary, from Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel to Donald Trump in the United States. Slowly, an international alliance has been forming among all those nations which, like ours, want to be free and believe in the ideas of liberty. And slowly, what once seemed like the absolute global hegemony of the woke left in politics, educational institutions, in the media, in supranational organizations, or even in forums like Davos, has begun to crumble. And a hope for the ideas of freedom is starting to emerge. Today, I've come here to tell you that our battle is not yet won. And although hope has been rekindled, it is our moral duty and our historical responsibility to dismantle the ideological edifice of sickly wokeism. Until we have succeeded in rebuilding our historical cathedral, until we have ensured that the majority of Western countries once again embrace the ideas of liberty, until our ideas become the common currency in the halls of events such as this one, we can't let our guard down. Because I must say that forums like this one have been protagonists and promoters of the sinister agenda of wokeism that is doing so much damage to the Western world. If we want to change, if we truly want to defend the rights of citizens, we must first begin by telling them the truth. And the truth is that there is something badly mistaken about the ideas that have been promoted through forums such as this one. And I would like to take a few minutes today to discuss some of them.
This is beautiful.
Today, few will deny that winds of change are blowing in the West. There are those who resist change, those who grudgingly accept it, but accept it nonetheless. There are the new converts who appear when they see it as inevitable. And finally, there's those of us who have fought all of our entire lives for change to arrive. Each one of you will know which group you belong to. Surely, there may be a bit of each within this auditorium, but you will all surely recognize that the times of change are knocking on our doors. Historic moments of change have a unique characteristic, the times when formulas that have been in place for decades become exhausted. The methods once considered the only way of doing things cease to make sense, and what to many seemed unquestionable truths is finally called into question. These are times when the rules get rewritten, and therefore these are times that reward those who have the courage to take risks. But much of the free world still prefers the comfort of what is familiar, even though it may be the wrong path, and they will insist on applying the recipes of failure. And the great burden that is the common denominator among the countries and institutions that are failing is the mental virus of woke ideology. This is the great epidemic of our time that must be cured. This is the cancer we need to get rid of. This ideology has colonized the world's most important institutions, from the political parties and governments of leading Western nations to global governance organizations, even NGOs, universities, and media outlets. It has also set the tone of the global conversation over the past decades. Until we remove this abhorrent ideology from our culture, our institutions, and our laws, Western civilization, and even the human species, will not be able to return to the path of progress demanded by our pioneering spirit. It is essential to break these ideological chains if we want to usher in a new golden age. That is why today I would like to take a few minutes to breaking those chains. But first, let's talk about what we're fighting for. The West represents the pinnacle of human achievement. On the fertile ground of its Greco-Roman heritage and Judeo-Christian values, the seeds of something unprecedented in history were sown. After definitively overcoming absolutism, liberalism inaugurated a new era in human existence. And within the new moral and philosophical framework, which placed individual liberty above the whims of tyrants, the West was able to unleash man's creative capacity, initiating an unprecedented process of wealth generation. The data speaks for itself. Until the year 1800, the world's per capita GDP remained virtually constant. However, from the 19th century onwards, and thanks to the Industrial Revolution, per capita GDP multiplied by 20, lifting 90% of the global population out of poverty, even though the population itself increased eightfold. And this was only possible thanks to a convergence of fundamental values, respect for life, liberty, and property, which enabled free trade, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and the other pillars of Western civilization. In addition, our inventive Faustian exploratory pioneering spirit, which is constantly testing the limits of what is possible. And that's a pioneering spirit that today is represented, among others, by my dear friend Elon Musk, who has been unjustly vilified by the wokeism ideology in recent days for an innocent gesture that simply reflects his enthusiasm and gratitude towards people. In summary, we invented capitalism on the basis of saving, investment, labor, and reinvestment, and hard work. We got every worker to multiply tenfold, a hundredfold, or why not even a thousandfold their productivity, thus overcoming the Malthusian trap. Yet at some point in the 20th century, we lost our way, and the liberal principles that had made us free and prosperous were betrayed. A new political class, driven by collectivist ideologies and taking advantage of times of crisis, saw the perfect opportunity to accumulate power. All the wealth created by capitalism until then and into the future would be redistributed through some scheme of centralized planning, setting in motion a process whose disastrous consequences we are suffering today. By promoting a socialist agenda while insidiously operating within the liberal paradigm, this new political class distorted the values of liberalism. And so they replaced freedom with liberation, using the coercive power of the state to redistribute the wealth created by capitalism. Their justification was the sinister, unjust, and abhorrent idea of social justice, complemented by theoretical Marxist frameworks aimed at liberating individuals from their needs. And at the core of this new value system lies the fundamental premise that equality before the law is not enough, as hidden systemic injustices exist which must be rectified, an idea that serves as a goldmine for bureaucrats who aspire to omnipotence. And this is fundamentally what wokeism is about, the result of the reversal of Western values. Each of our civilization's pillars has been replaced by a distorted version of itself through various mechanisms of cultural subversion. Negative rights to life, liberty, and property were transformed into an artificial and endless list of positive rights. First, it was education, then housing, and from then on, absurdities like access to the internet, televised football, theater, cosmetic treatments, and an endless number of other desires that were turned into fundamental human rights. Rights that, of course, someone has to pay for, and which can only be guaranteed through the infinite expansion of the abhorrent state. In other words, we move from the concept of freedom as the fundamental protection of the individual against the intervention of the tyrant to the concept of liberation through state intervention. On this foundation, wokeism was built, an ideology of monolithic thinking upheld by various institutions whose purpose is to penalize dissent. Feminism, diversity, inclusion, equity, immigration, abortion, environmentalism, gender ideology, among others, these are all various heads of the same beast, aimed at justifying the state's expansion through the appropriation and distortion of noble causes. Let us look at some of these. Radical feminism is a distortion of the concept of equality. Even in its most benevolent form, it is redundant, as equality before the law already exists in the West. Everything else is a quest for privileges, which is what radical feminism truly seeks, pitting half of the population against the other half when they should both be on the same side. We have even got to the point of normalizing the fact that in many supposedly civilized countries, if you kill a woman, it is called femicide, and this carries more serious punishment than if you kill a man, simply based on the sex of the victim, legally making a woman's life be worth more than that of a man. And that they carry the banner of the gender-based wage gap, but when you look at the data, it is clear that there is no inequality for the same work, but rather that most men tend to choose better-paid professions than most women. However, they don't complain about the fact that most prison inmates are men, or that most plumbers are men, or that most victims of robbery or murder are men, let alone the majority of people who have died in wars. But if you...
Well, I'm going to go ahead and stop it there because I think we get the gist again. No sense in like just, you know, listening to the whole thing, just to listen to the whole thing. There's a lot to unpack there, but boy, talk about, because I hadn't heard that yet. And I'm, he wasn't holding back at all. In fact, I think Shelley was right on the money that guy's speech was actually better than Trump's.
Well, Trump had to maintain a certain level of diplomacy
and decorum.
But Milei doesn't.
Right.
He comes from he explained the history of his country, and he comes from a position of no more. That's the past. We're moving on. And again, his attitude is to WEF, you either accept what we're doing, whether you want to engage in it or not, or quite simply, fuck off. Yeah. And that was the overall message between the two of them. No, there's new sheriffs in town, and this is the way it's going to be. And if you don't like it, too bad. But we're not suffering anymore for this agenda.
One of the things I found interesting about what Trump said initially was that, and I said this before and I forgot I said it, then I apologize, guys, for repeating myself. But he overemphasized how big he won. And basically that was telling Davos, we don't give a shit about all your policies. The entire country is behind me. And we're going to go forward with my plan and not yours.
Yeah.
And I mean,
your plan is dead in our country.
Right. But he was also trying to be conciliatory to them. It's like, look, we want to do business with you.
Yeah.
We want to do business with you. Yeah. Work with us. But we're not going to play your game. You're going to play our game. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me, you remember the movie Tombstone, when Kurt Russell walks into the bar and the bar is empty and the guy is at the faro table and
Billy Bob Thornton is treating the guests like shit.
Right. He goes in there and he freaking just kicks his ass out. And the next thing you know, the freaking place is just bustling. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Billy Bob Thornton is a representation of the European Union and all their freaking heavy laden taxes and regulations. And Trump is coming in and saying, "Nah, we're not going to do it that way anymore." And there's nothing they can do, nothing. So
no, there isn't.
Yeah, I have an idea that Malay and Trump coordinated that Malay had a lot more liberty, like you said, to be not necessarily, I mean, he was still diplomatic, but he let them have it. That was awesome. That was really awesome.
And I wanted to see over time, because you just don't go trusting someone like Malay at first. Let time dictate, his actions dictate how to look at him. And yeah, so far so good.
I didn't watch any of the other, any of the world leaders that spoke. But I find it,
unless you needed a nap,
right? Well, I don't know if there were any other world leaders that would have been like on Trump's and Malay's side. But I do feel like there are some that are coming.
I think the Italian,
leader. Well, that's right. Yeah. The Italian one.
There's a few others. But I think they're wanting to keep a low profile in their backyard. They're going to do what they're going to do. They don't just they're under no obligation to get in front of this gaggle of fools and Schwab and the rest and tell them what they're going to do. Right. They can do what, let's say, within the confines of their agreements with the European Union. But you know, you're seeing that start to come to fray at the edges. Mm-hmm. Because I know in Finland they won out. Several other countries there's a groundswell like there was in Great Britain
mm-hmm.
to leave because it's not serving them. It's taxing them.
Yeah, it's
limiting them.
Well, I mean, but that's what it was designed to do. The European Union was essentially a function of, you know, basically global control, uniting all of these individual countries and under one state, very similar to the way the United States is operating. But it was, instead of it being a where you didn't have the super strong Well, the United States didn't have the super strong central government, at least at the beginning. And what the European Union did is they brought it in with the super heavy hand of the European Union and essentially dictating to everybody, if you're going to you're gonna be part of this state and you're going to do exactly what we're going to tell you to do, and there's nothing you can do about it. So, you know, I find that very interesting. That a lot of these countries, they want out.
Well, one of the things that pulled their teeth in a lot of these countries to begin with was going to the euro instead of having their own
currency.
Currency is at the forefront, which, you know, left room for them to, through the games played with arbitrage, to maintain stronger positions in what they believed. But, you know, you've had this forced conglomeration in that body over there, and it just doesn't work. It will not work.
Right.
You know, well, it's that simple.
You know, there was the European Union was, you know, the origins of it were born out of the end result of World War II. And then, that wasn't the only continent that they wanted to do that with. They also wanted to do it with the United States and, you know,
and Africa
and South America and Asia. Yeah. Now, the one thing do you remember the 2007 Lou Dobbs, when he was working at CNN and he did a report on the North American Union with and having the United States and Mexico and Canada basically merge under a North American Union using the Amero. Well,
yeah.
Recently he's been talking about, you know, making Canada a state. Well, Trump has.
Mm-hmm.
But, and a lot of people are saying, oh, he's talking about globalism. He wants to make them global. He wants to convert it into globalism. And what I tend to believe is that the everything that Trump is talking about, he's bringing the conversation out into the fore. But a lot of the stuff that he's talking about has already happened. It happened in 2007 whenever Bush was president, him and Vicente Fox of Mexico. And I can't remember who the prime minister of Canada was at the time, but apparently they already signed all this deal, you know, behind closed doors. And even though outwardly it still appears as though they're three individual countries, inwardly, it's not that way. Inwardly, they are operating as kind of like one entity. Have you heard that?
Mm. Yeah, aspects to that effect. There's a comment that caught my eye. John J. Johnson 3 says, yeah, this side of the pond is one big bureaucratic scheme made to give the illusion of sovereignty. And being Finnish, you take even more shit on top of it. Mm. And, you know, that's a good point, because it's the same thing they were trying to pull here off and on and quite heavily over the last 4 years. The entire concept of you know, that all that we've dealt with what we know is covert, largely foreign, not by not any means all foreign, but with foreign assistance, was to move everything again over further to what you'd call left, which in a sense would be socialism. Democracy is a code word again for socialism.
That's right.
Socialism being one step away from totalitarianism.
Correct.
We've called it many things in the past, fascism, communism, you name it. But, you know, And it's not that difficult to see the different NGOs and organizations that have been working along with that. And I would go so far as to call them seditious groups with equally foreign agendas that they're trying to push and bring this country to its knees. I mean, in reality, all of the nonsense that we've witnessed in the last 4 years, it just didn't happen. It happened because it was planned.
Exactly.
Everything from the gender dysphoria to DEI, all of this garbage and nonsense, all the way into up to and including the taking down of statues and the renaming of bases. You know, it's history revisionism, which is a move of the fool, of the useful idiot.
It's straight out of Marx.
Exactly. That's why I use the term useful idiot, because you can forgive so much of people being young, but today, unfortunately, they're young and woefully uneducated and stupid as a result. So they're quick to run out and support these things. Knowing common sense, without even looking at statistics or actual real polls that actually try to reach a true conclusion. The amount of population we're talking about is less than 1%. Yet for these years we've had that wagged in our faces incessantly, to the point to where one arm of their propaganda machine is withering on the vine for everyone to see. I would caution people, no matter what they're saying on these various networks that seem, well, that's not so bad. No, that's meant to lure you in. This is social engineering on a mass scale. Don't fall for it. And we cannot fall for it.
Let's see here. Foxtrot 75 said Trump signed an executive order regarding the SES. When someone asked about it, Trump said it was a cancer. Can anybody talk about that? I've not been able to find the information on the EO. Have you heard anything about that?
I did hear that comment was made regarding SES. And yes, it is a cancer. When was it formed? Late 70s, under the Carter administration. Why was it formed? They'll use the nonsense of, it's been a long day, continuity of government. Well, that's an easy function, a very small one of it, because if you're spread out throughout every department, you're not working for them, but you're being paid by SES, then it's easy to say that. But
I'm not sure that was. I'm not sure that the executive order was directed specifically at SES.
It might have had effects on it, but I don't know. I can't comment on the EO.
I think it was because remember what he talked about at the speech at Davos. He said that he initiated a hiring freeze, and he also made it easier for federal employees to be fired. And you got to remember, SES is under the SES is under the executive branch. So he can fire the SES at will. That the president has the authority to do that. He is the executive of the government, and all those departments fall under the executive branch, not the legislative branch. Which is really interesting. And you know, you go back and you look at, you know, Trump made this speech, and he made this statement, and I don't remember exactly when it was, but it was within the last couple of years. He talked about how the executive branch has had more power than it's ever had in its history of the government. That the legislative branch has ceded control to the executive branch, and obviously with the
because
purposes,
we're in a state of emergency. Right.
But not just that. I mean, like much on a much deeper level than that, almost to the point where, in many respects, the executive branch can legislate just with the stroke of a pen, almost like a dictator. And to me, I find it very interesting that, you know, you look at why would they do that? Well, because they had Obama and they had Hillary waiting in the wings. And if Hillary came in, then they could have done a whole bunch of stuff. And the reason that I feel like what you talked about, that the Biden administration was not really the Biden administration, but it was much more controlled, is that that was almost, in a way, a clandestine second Trump term. But it was done with the purpose of making it appear as though Biden was in control, when I'm still, you know, and nobody's ever going to make me believe that that was really the same human being that was the vice president under Obama. They may have looked similar, but I just don't think those were the same two people. But that aside, there were too many things that they did that were just, I mean, they were just crazy, totally outlandish. It's like, how in the world would you, why would you do that? That doesn't, that's like, it makes no sense. It's, and the only reason that you would do it would be to literally like cause chaos and discontent within the populace. And then who's going to come in and save the day? Trump. So, you know, and I don't have anything to substantiate that. That's just, you know, the kind of like the little twinkly feeling in my head. But
I think we're going to see things that back that up in the coming years.
I agree. Another thing that let's move on to this cartel thing, because this is a big deal, and I'm not gonna because the videos are short, I'm gonna let them play at just regular speed. But I mean, these are two very good takes that I don't think the American people are ready for, and I really, really want your take on this. I actually was going to call you this morning and to talk about them, but I thought, you know what, I'll just wait until this afternoon, because and you know, make this part of the show. That way we can talk about it and then everybody else can hear our conversation. So that said, I'm going to play the first one. This is from a guy who this is an interview with a guy who is a former Navy SEAL. So with that, here we go.
What are your thoughts on Trump designating the cartels as a terrorist organization and essentially leveraging the U.S. military to combat them?
The short answer is I'm not sure. And the reason I say that is that I'm not opposed to it necessarily. But that's one of those things where if I really take a step back and before I just kind of default to the like AA personality, special operations, slap your on the counter, ego based, like, yeah, let's go these guys up kind of thing, is think, okay, before we do that, is there a smarter way to accomplish, you know, what is the goal, right? The goal is to stop massive amounts of illegal narcotics streaming across the border completely unfettered, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so is that the smartest way to accomplish that, is to say, okay, we're going to designate these guys as terrorist groups, and now we're going to use American special operations and the full brunt of all of our nation's intelligence agencies, our SIGINT, our COMINT, our HUMINT, you know, the full brunt of the way that we would attack ISIS or Al-Qaeda or whoever overseas, is we're going to put that same kind of pressure on them. I would ask, okay, well, first, you know, from a success standpoint and replicating success, is look at what the current threats are from a terrorist standpoint. Look at the amount of money, manpower, resources that we've put into fighting terrorism. Now, have we defeated it in some ways? Yes. If you look at it from a global standpoint, like, have we stifled that methodology at all? I don't think so. You could argue we've made it worse. So to me, like, that's a big strike in the con column for defaulting or starting out with that as an option. I wouldn't remove that from the table. I'm certainly not scared to do that, but you do have to realize the fucking mess that's going to come out of that, because those guys aren't chumps. You know, they're at least as well funded, if not considerably better funded than terrorist organizations, right? They're also a lot closer. We're not talking about, you know, thousands.
Great point.
Yeah, thousands. You're not talking about thousands of miles of ocean separating us, where it's way harder for ISIS. Well, they can come to Mexico and walk across at this point. And I know a lot of them have in the last 4 years. That's another topic we can discuss. But, you know, to me, again, it's like the Sun Tzu art of war, is that, you know, like, you got to know your fucking enemy, know what they're capable of. And so to me, like, doing that as a step one, I think, is akin to, you know, trying to mop up the floor of a bathroom where the toilet's overflowing while the toilet is still overflowing. You know, it's the same analogy I would use with trying to debate, you know, immigration policy when the border is wide open. I think step one is you got to close the fucking border. I think before we really attack making, you know, as impenetrable of a border as we can possibly make, even having that discussion is a waste of fucking time, because while that's open, if you attack them, right, it's like fucking cockroaches. You look at Afghanistan-Pakistan border as a classic example. What happened when they went to Pakistan? What's going to happen? You start attacking them there. Where do you think they're going to go?
They just keep, yeah. They're
going to fucking come here.
Right.
Right. And they're going to come here and they're going to bring the fight. And, you know, you're going to see fucking congressmen getting assassinated. You're going to see their kids getting fucking kidnapped. You're going to see all kinds of gnarly shit that I'm not sure that this country is ready for.
I certainly think not.
You know, and to think that we have the ability to just go there and completely mop the floor with everybody, I think, is an arrogant and dangerous perspective. Again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't keep that option on the table, but I think until we put enough resources on the border to say we legitimately have a handle on this and can keep, you know, people from coming across at will, it's a waste of an argument, and it would be a waste of I would rather see U.S. military resources be put on the border, frankly, and close it and absolutely and actually shut it down before you even have that conversation. At that same time, I would put a similar amount of resources into finding the bad actors that are currently in this country and getting rid of them. I don't think it makes sense to try to round up everybody who's here illegally, because there's tens of millions of people that fall into that category. And I think you got to prioritize in the same way an ER doctor would triage a bus crash. Is that you got to say who are the people we're most worried about? Unfortunately, we don't even know who the fuck those people are.
That's the problem. But, how are you going to confiscate all the guns?
Yeah, trying to sift through, there are people that we do know are here, who are here illegally, who are convicted fucking horrible criminals. I think you go after them first. That's the logical step. And so, you know, to me, it's like, let's focus on those two things first. And I would also use negotiation as a power tool also. And that I would, like, if I was Trump, I would contact not just the Mexican president. I mean, I would find a way to reach out to cartel leadership and say, look, you know, we can fucking go this route if you guys want. It's going to be bad for both of us. Or you guys can fucking police your own and stop bringing shit across, but it's not going to fucking pan out. And try to figure out a way to at least, you know, communicate, you know, some sort of warning that way of saying, like, look, we don't want to go this fucking route, but you have to realize, like, you know, the actions that your organizations are doing are killing more of our citizens than wars, than terrorism, than fucking, you know, a lot of other things that people tend to focus on more than drug streaming across the border. I mean, when there's six figures, you know, 100,000 people overdosing annually on fucking drugs, like, I mean, that is a natural catastrophe. You know, I mean, that's bigger than, you know, if you look at the hurricane damage and the wildfire damage, and, you know, I mean, like, there's not even close to those kinds of numbers of American citizens dying from it. So you've got to figure out a way to try to, you know, kind of threaten, you know, that walking with a big stick of saying, like, look, again, we can go down this road if you want, but it's going to be fucking bloody and you know, we won't stop if you don't fucking, you know, stay at it. So I think I would do those things first.
I love the idea of sitting down and having that conversation, even with the Mexican president and the cartel leaders. And
yeah, because it's not like they're not in bed together. I mean,
right. You know. Well, and that's the other part of the problem is I think there's so much money in federal funding for programs, for everything else that, you know, undoing a lot of that has been the conspiratorial claim anyway. And I damn sure guarantee you that it's making Mexico a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, like, again, putting yourself in the shoes of the cartels, like, I mean, I think that's important is that you can be one-sided, but you're going to probably lose if you just look at it from our perspective. Like, if I'm one of those guys and the U.S. government says, hey, you need to knock this shit off, I'm like, why? Right. What's my motivation to
stop
doing
it? That's what they do. Yeah. I mean, it's not like they go take the secondary job.
So to me, the best, you know, I mean, I do think it's still important to communicate that to them so that they know, like, hey, we're not fucking around. Like, we're going to warn you and say, like, look, here's the deal. But to me, putting pressure on Mexico as a country, as a government of saying, you know, if you guys don't actively at least try to stop it. And it's very obvious that you guys are putting in a lot of effort. And I know it sucks for you guys because you're
definitely does.
You know, it's a rock and a hard place, but tough shit. Like, you've let your country get to this point. Like, that's not our problem. It's your fucking problem. But we're going to make it our problem if you don't do something. And I would use, you know, trade imbalances and, you know, find ways to incentivize them and basically force them, you know, to at least tackle the problem to the best of their ability. You know, I know it would suck, but to me, it's kind of like layers of an onion. There's not one solution. I see, you know, people saying, just designate them as a terrorist group and fucking, you know, send Delta Force after them. And it's like, I don't think that that's going to solve the fucking problem.
Well, it doesn't eradicate the trade. That's the problem.
Yeah, the demand
get rid of
is
Escobar
there.
And then is that the end of the cocaine trade? Well,
yeah, I mean, no. You cut the head off and five more grow back. You know, so yeah, I mean, like, I think that perpetuates combative operations with our southern neighbor, which is not desirable. Yeah. And so I think you've got to take a multi-step approach, you know, begin and until you shut the border down, I don't think really any of it matters because, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, even if you completely defeated them or decimated them to a point where they were retreating, like, where are they going to retreat to? Here,
right.
You know, or at a minimum, like, they have the ability to, if you're putting pressure on them there, to come here. And I think nobody wants that, right. You know, so
that definitely would worsen it.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to just shut the fucking border down. Like, it doesn't seem that complicated to me, but. Anyway, it's kind of a long tail on that kite answer.
Well, I think it's a terrific answer. And like I said, it's just been the politics and the money that's coming in and out of both countries based on that. But if you have somebody that's dedicated to doing that, I think that's a great place to start. And you could at least make some progress in different areas and maybe pivot from there and figure out.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what you negotiate with people that are going to do it regardless, because that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah. I mean, I guess maybe negotiate isn't even the right word. It's more of a you know, the same way, you know, when Reagan came into office and, you know, basically, I mean, fuck, Trump's already done it for that matter. I was going to use Reagan and Libya as an example, but, you know, Trump's done it with, I mean, look, Hamas and Israel signed a peace treaty today, as a matter of fact, you know, and the day after Trump got elected, you look at a lot of these things, I mean, that was one of the first things they said is like, hey, we're ready to negotiate now. Like, the second he gets elected, like, that tells you a lot. Yeah. So, you know, by kind of carrying that big stick and saying like, hey, we'll give you a chance to fucking not have to, for both of us to have to fucking bloody ourselves, but if it comes to that, we will absolutely fucking do it. And unlike the current administration, we will take the fucking gloves off and we will come at you with every fucking thing our government has, including airstrikes. And when you start talking about we're moving away from law enforcement to the full brunt of the U.S. military, that's a whole different fucking ballgame. So to me, that's another thing from a negotiating tool with Mexico. Like, hey, we get that you're a sovereign nation, but with what you're allowing to come into our country right now, we will start fucking bombing the shit out of your country if you don't fix it. So pick one.
Right.
You know, you can either go after the cartel and try to police your own, or you can expect F-18s to be bombing the fucking dog shit out of your country for the next fucking 2 years.
And that may be literally the big stick that we're talking about anyway. Just the fact that you're going to leverage the designation in the first place doesn't mean that that's when you send troops.
Yeah.
That just means now the designation exists and now you have a little bit more negotiating power. Maybe that's where they're leaning, but
yeah.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough scenario all the way around. But
all right, so there's that one. Now,
I disagree with half of what he said. Because, number one, if he doesn't think there's already plans in place for these kinds of things, he's being naive. Number two, if you designate them terrorist organizations, which you have to, you don't negotiate with terrorists. And you don't even think of giving them a seat at a table. I don't care how many hundreds of billions or trillions are involved in the laundering of this money that actually does go into our economy.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to make certain major changes of an economic nature, those are already being factored in. You don't give cartels a seat at the table.
Well, I don't,
he should know that if you're going to go head to head with them eventually, because it will come to that, Mexico is not going there. I'm sorry, anybody who thinks that the government of Mexico and its bureaucrats are going to all of a sudden turn on the very ones who've been greasing their palms and making their careers, think again. They're not. If they do anything, it will be token and it will be temporary. And it will not have any teeth to it. So we're stuck. We're the ones stuck between a rock and a hard place.
And I agree with that.
Not a bad one. It's no, we're going to do this.
Right.
And it's not going to take 2 years of bombing the shit out of them. Going after key players, eliminating them. And then anyone who rises in to fill the power vacuum, same thing.
Well, okay. So now, this is the other one that I wanted your take on. And this one is a lot more, the one that I played first was more like an overarching strategic, view. This one is more of like a tactical on the ground, possible outcome. And so this is the one that I'm saving this for last, because this is the one that I really, really wanted your take on. But so here we go.
If you've never spent a day overseas, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan, or you don't serve in some type of civil service post, whether it's the police, ATF, DEA, fast teams, and you're out here saying that special forces is going to crush the cartel, you just need to shut the fuck up, because you have no idea the world hurt that we're in for. It's going down, right? President Trump just signed an executive order designating the cartels, all of them, as terrorist organization. And what that allows them to do is to use special forces, Delta Force, Green Berets, Navy SEALs, to go after the cartels. How is that going to pan out? I personally think it's a bad fucking idea, and we're in for a world of hurt once this thing starts unfolding. Before we jump into it, guys, I'm going to read you guys this article. The title of the article is Drug Cartels Now Mexico's Fifth Largest Employer. Some 175,000 people now actively work for Mexico's drug smuggling cartel. According to this estimate, the cartel has the ability to recruit more than 350 people a day. That's the machine that U.S. Special Forces would be going up against. And while all this is developing, what do you guys think Mexico's going to be doing in the background? Let me know in the comment section. Because keep in mind, Mexico is a sovereign nation. We're not at war with Mexico. So in order to go in there, more than likely, we're going to need permission from them. Let's now talk about titles and authorities. Within the military or the Department of Defense and all these different entities, the president has to look at titles and authorities, giving him the ability to use certain forces to go action certain targets. The military, the DOD, we operate under Title 10. The CIA, they operate under Title 50. The National Guard, that's Title 32. So under Title 50, the CIA would be able to employ clandestine operation to gather intelligence, to disrupt the cartel's logistical chain, and to infiltrate their ranks without the public knowing. Using Title 50, the CIA can also train local militias and employ them to fight cartel members. But to be able to do that, guys, guess what the CIA needs? It needs permission from the Mexican government, whose fifth largest employer just happens to be the cartel. How do you guys think that's going to pan out? That's Title 50 under the CIA. Under Title 10, the military can employ overwhelming firepower to try to dismantle the cartel. They also can train military police, the Mexican government, to essentially go after cartel members. But again, just like Title 50, under Title 10, we still need permission from the Mexican government. Whatever we decide to do, Mexico has to be on board with it. If they're not, then we're essentially invading another country that's right on our border to go do work. It's not a good idea, guys. Like, whatever we decide to do, Mexico has to bless off on. And if they haven't been doing that thus far, what makes you think that they're going to go along with this plan? Again, there's a lot of moving pieces here that we have to take in mind before we go do this. And what's the blowback of not doing it right? What country is currently going through something like this right now? Israel. Israel shares a border with everyone that's trying to fucking destroy them, right? And how's that turning out? Do we want to become Israel? Do we want to be at war with Mexico and the cartel? Ask yourself that question. Now, let's look at strategy. If you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, the way we went in and the way we left, are those countries better or are they worse? And that's a legit question, guys, because we spent 20 years in Afghanistan, 20 years in Iraq, and all we did was just kill a bunch of freaking high-level leaders. 20 years, 20 different wars. That was our strategy. We went in, find whoever was in charge, kill them. And in the following year, when somebody else took charge, kill them. And that was it. That's all we did in those countries. Are we going to use a similar strategy to fight off the cartel? It's not wise. Because if we go into Mexico, hunt down cartel leaders and kill them, guess what? Someone else is going to take their place. We kill them, someone else is going to take their place, guys. Because guess what, man? We did it in Colombia. We did it in Venezuela when we were fighting the freaking narco war down there. And guess what? We still have this problem. So again, we got to make sure we go in with the right strategy. And on top of that, biggest mistake we made in Iraq and Afghanistan is we didn't respect our enemy. We thought we were just fighting dudes with fucking manjams and flip-flops. Guess what? 20 years later, guess who's laughing? They are. So again, we have to employ the right strategy going into Mexico, or else it's going to be a fucking bloodbath. Staying along the lines of strategy, going into Mexico, you got to keep these factors in mind. 32 million people currently living in the United States are of Mexican descent. Another 62 million has ties to Latin America. What do you guys think the appetite is going to be from the local population when they see on television body parts, bummed out kids, family shot to death because we are down there doing work? And for you to think that the cartel doesn't have a robust IO campaign, then you're mistaken. The freaking Afghan people were able to run theirs efficiently using fucking Nokia phones. We would go to a village, do work. By the time we get back to the FOB, we're already shut down for 24 to 48 hours because of SIFCAS. Another thing you got to keep in mind, guys. Again, having been there, done it, seen it, I can see these things happening. We go down there and fuck with Jose and them. And then all they do is they go to Juarez or some other town in Mexico, kidnap a family, and coerce guys in the United States, citizens, law-abiding citizens, to turn towards the U.S. citizens and cause them harm. There's been a shit ton of cases where we're in Afghanistan doing work. Taliban goes into this village, kidnap a dude's family. That's part of the Afghan local police. Next thing you know, he turns an AK-47 onto his U.S. partners. You guys don't think that's going to happen when we go down there and start fucking up Jose and them? You don't think they're going to use that TTP? Unlike Afghanistan, Iraq, and all these other places that we fought, we don't have an ocean between us and Mexico, guys. And the cartel, they're freaking ruthless. So to think that they're not going to start using and employing those tactics, you're out of your mind. So when I see people on YouTube talking about, oh, we're going to crush the cartel, it's about time, I'm like, dude, I'm going to be in Walmart looking at fucking Jesus and them sideways. Like, dude, I know they just kill your fucking homeboys down there, but don't even fucking think about it. Because that's all it takes. As a man, as a protector of your family, regardless of where you're at, the United States, Mexico, Iraq, Afghanistan, your family gets kidnapped, your kids get picked up, you're going to do whatever the fuck you need to do to get them back home safe. And to say that you won't, you're lying to yourself. How do we actually win the war against the cartel? How do we actually fix this issue? I hate to break it to you guys, but we can't. We won't be able to. Fuck, we can't even fix Chicago. What makes you guys think that we're going to be able to fix this issue with the cartel? It's not going to happen. Why? For a couple of different things. Mexican government is corrupt as shit. Hell, some part of our government is corrupt. So to think that we're going to go down there, knock out a couple of people, and it is going to fix everything, it's not. Supply and demand. As long as Americans keep wanting drugs, there's going to be people to supply drugs to Americans. That's just how that works. Right? So again, corrupt government, as long as that's in place, that's not going to happen, guys. So if we want to truly affect this, we got to work on the Mexican government, which again, puts us in the state of nation building, which is where we don't want to be. The second thing that we can do, guys, is we can target the money. Instead of targeting individuals or the cartel themselves, we need to target the money. Target and follow the money. And more than likely, that shit's going to lead right back to the fucking United States. Yep, that's exactly what's going to happen. It's going to lead to Miami and some other places in the freaking U.S. Because for the cartel to be as big as they are right now, they got to have some type of link to the United States. They got to have politicians. That's just how this shit works. So if we really, truly want to affect this, we got to follow the money, and we have to target that. Last but not least, we got to take care of the root of the problem. There's a reason why a bunch of people are dying from fucking fentanyl overdose. It's because they're fucking addicts. It's because they love drugs. They know that they might end up with a bad batch and dying, but that's not stopping them from doing fucking drugs. That's the problem. Not the cartel, not Mexico. It's the citizens of the United States that's consuming drugs at an alarming rate. Earlier in the video, I talked about supply and demand. If we want drugs and we crush the cartel, guess what? Another entity is going to rise to fill the gap. And what are we going to do? Go to war with that country too? Go to war with that entity also? How about we look inward and do a better fucking job at raising our kids and policing up our youth and teaching them that doing a pile of fucking cocaine isn't the right thing to do? If there's no supply, guess what? There's no cartel to supply it. There's no fentanyl deaths. We can crush the cartel today like this. But as long as Americans want their drugs, guess what? They're going to find a way to get it. Hell, they'll go all the way to fucking Ukraine to get the drugs. And as long as we want it, there's going to be people out there that are going to be creative to find a way to get it to us. It just happens to be the cartel now. But crushing them isn't going to fix the underlying issue, which is we are a country addicted to fucking drugs. That's the end of it, guys. But let me know what you guys think, guys. I just wanted to come on here and do a breakdown for you guys because I know this is a hot topic.
All right.
There's one thing I agree with him on, fixing things here at home. But again, we have a misery index that's off the charts now.
Mm-hmm.
Afghanistan, Iraq, the drug problem itself. These were all political and agenda-driven things that were supported. And look the other way all these years since the five-star drug.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so number one, I think, you know, he's right on the aspect of raising our kids right and et cetera, but we have a lot of things to overcome that economics has driven many to. Look at all the tent cities. They even number them in various cities.
It's crazy.
Okay. So I would expect these people, unfortunately, being human, they're going to seek some kind of escape. And obviously the shit in the needles all over the sidewalk is all you need to see.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, what he's got to understand is that the rise of the cartels would have never happened had political and, moral will were in place to not let it happen. It wouldn't have happened nearly to the extent it is. So, and you don't send, let me finish this thought. You don't send special forces in first. Of course this is why I said on another show, it will take a while before it gets to that point. You have to shore up the border. You have to shore up certain economic aspects. You have to shore up quite a few things. You have to shore up your personnel and your training, all of it. Because we've had too much of an influx of weakening of the military with DEI and admirals who were born with penises wearing dresses, generals, etc. All of this nonsense, okay? Once exactly. You clear all that out, once you make your bed, then you go to work. But you don't send special forces out there on their own. You let them do what they do in the context. And if he doesn't think we're going to use, let's say, surgical munitions with or without Mexico's blessing, think again. Because it's not 100,000, it's over 200,000. When in the entire course of the Vietnam War, we lost 60-something thousand men to direct killed in action. So there's a lot of, you know, knee-jerk thinking in both him and the last individual in their responses. Do they know their stuff as far as special operations? Absolutely, I wouldn't question that with them. But I would question their, 20,000-foot view, because it isn't a 60 or 80,000-foot view by any stretch. And... we haven't coordinated forces like Coast Guard interdiction. We haven't taken the handcuffs off of interception and interdiction. We leave it to guys at the border, and we leave it to people at airports. Well, that's not going to cut it by any stretch. This has to be prepared for time. All the cartels need to know is if you don't shift or you don't start going legitimate, don't care what you do. It's coming for you. It has to end. 200,000 American lives. I don't care how you slice it. It's worth whatever it takes. And yes, we know we already have bad apples in this country from south of the border who mm-hmm. would react and respond in such a way. Various groups that have been in existence for a long time who would probably be a part of that. I'm not going to name them. I don't want them going, getting all hot and bothered under the collar.
Right.
But the reality is, doesn't matter. If you're in this country, you're here because most of them wanted to get the hell away from that stuff. Do you think they're going to go, oh, you're killing people in my neighborhood? How many people died in their neighborhoods before they left?
Right.
Okay. So let's get real with this whole thing. If I fled, if the U.S., if it were in reverse and I fled to Mexico, I'd be like, use whatever the hell you think you need to use to stop that shit. As an American. So this all of this thinking is just rudimentary. And yeah, get the point, but you're not looking at the entire picture.
And well, I mean, obviously those are just two very short anecdotal things from guys who are, you know, who were in the military, mm-hmm. Who had some experience in dealing with some of the things, and they both questioned. My thing is that they were both questioning the validity of just going straight after the throat of the cartels when they could be doing some other things. You know,
and those things will be done. Yeah, it would be stupid not to do them mm-hmm. all in concert.
Well, you know, I posted these two in a board that I'm on, and I said, you know, I was in the military, and I know a lot of who served, and I know about history and how military commanders arrogantly underestimate enemy forces and overestimate their capabilities, with the boots on the ground suffering the consequences from that arrogance. And the boots on the ground in this particular case would be the American people, and they would be some of the soldiers who, if they got caught, would undoubtedly suffer almost worse fates than what happened in, you know, in the Southern Pacific during World War II.
And then what do you do? You make it harder on the enemy.
Right.
You do the same thing to them.
You have to. But you don't
show the people that. You don't show them what you're doing down and dirty because, again, you know, when it comes to war, most aren't grown up enough to accept the realities of it still.
Well, the crazy thing is, where do these people learn it all? Where do these people learn it?
Well,
They learn it from all over.
Well, from the Russians, they learn it from other of their own region. No one is saying it's a simple problem. But no one is saying you just throw. Okay, today we're going to throw forces at them. Of course, you don't do it that way.
Right.
And, you know, so I get where they're coming from, but, you know, they're also operating under a normalcy bias that these types of operations would be handled as they had been in the last 20 years. I beg to differ. I don't think they would. You'd be foolish to do that. The enemy has already studied that. If they're smart, they've already studied our rules of engagement, what we are willing and not willing to do. Well, no, different conflict, newer minds, a president an administration that is dedicated to actually doing something about it, you're damn right it can be wiped out. People want to do drugs. Guess what? If it's not available, it's going to be one-tenth as bad. If 20,000 compared to 200,000 died a year, it's not acceptable, but it's far more preferable to 200,000.
Let me ask you, if Ghost was in charge of doing what he could to solve the problem of the cartels, this is a random question. What would be some of the things that you would do?
Mapping out the money that comes into these organizations and then where it's going, exactly who's involved, no matter who it is, what American and foreign banks are involved, whether they know it or not, they do know it. Look at what happened a few years ago. Look at Wells Fargo, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look at the reality of the money first and then how to ease any type of negative impact that would have economically. And once you've tackled that issue to satisfaction, then you move on to, well, obviously at the same time, you're sealing that border tight. And you're not only sealing it tight, but if certain types of kinetic operations begin, you also have to, and I don't know whether people are going to like what they're hearing or not, you mine the first 100 yards or so beyond that fence. And you mine it's it like, with mines.
There's a lot of people who don't know about the walls that were used to keep people in the Eastern Bloc countries. A lot of people think that, oh, well, once they got over the wall, it was over. No, that was just that was the easy part. That
the mines was the easy and the part. Electronic countermeasures were the hard part.
You had because once you got over the wall, then you had to go through like 100 yards of 50 to 100 yards of, you know, of either mined, like you said, or electronic countermeasures where like they had sensors where people would come out. I mean, there was you know, guard towers that would just shoot on sight. There was a lot of different things that were going on, and to your point, I think it would be, you know, that would be a very interesting. Be a very, very, very interesting to do. I do agree that the first thing that needs to happen is to close the border, just to get mm-hmm. and I'm seeing, you know, we haven't really talked. I went down to Mexico on Thursday to finish my dental work, and when I was driving down there, Interstate 8. Goes from San Diego all the way into a little town called Casa Grande in Arizona, where it merges with I-10. So Interstate 8 isn't very long. It's about probably, I don't know, 200 miles. And it's pretty much just a straightaway in the middle of the desert that runs parallel to the Mexico border. Well, everywhere in the... You know, all over the southwestern part of the United States, wherever there's a border with Mexico, you have random checkpoints and people know where they are, that are Border Patrol checkpoints. And they're not looking for, I mean, what they're looking for is they're looking for either drugs or they're looking for illegals. Oh, excuse me. And what they did here is they had the Border Patrol erected a makeshift checkpoint where there wasn't one. I'd never seen that before in my entire life. And I was like, whoa, this is nuts. Now, you know, I wasn't like, I wasn't freaking out because, I mean, it was, you know, they don't, who am I? You know, I'm a Caucasian, I'm an older Caucasian guy, you know, driving a fairly nice car. And, you know, there's no way that I had anybody in my car. I mean, it was too small. So they let me go, and they let most people go. But the point of the matter is that I'm seeing tactics used at the border now. And on my way back, when I actually came through the one checkpoint, I chuckled at the guys as I was coming through, and I was like, "You guys are probably your guys' job just got a whole lot easier." And the guy smiled and said, "Absolutely." And yeah, I mean, it's obvious that you know, he what he meant, that these guys have been having to do their job with both hands tied behind their back and their feet tied together, you know, trying to chase around sprinters. It's ridiculous. And now, you know, I'm seeing images of just massive amounts of military, either national, I don't know if it's normal military or like regular military, or if it's National Guard or what it is, but these are all things. These are all units that are now, you know, it's like a buzzsaw at the border with activity of men and women who are there to protect the border. And that's a good thing. That's the way it should have been. You know, when the main reason that I knew the war on terror was a fraud is that they left the border wide open. Did I lose you? Ghost, you're muted.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was saying there's on the border, there's a mixture of guard and reserve and active. There's quite a few down there now. And what you, again, the drug epidemic, the terrorist sideshow, all of these things were not only fomented and fermented by, let's say, certain organizations here and especially abroad. It was all part of the globalist agenda to weaken this nation and bring it to its knees. So you never had, from day one, when Nixon created the DEA and Elvis got involved, taking all those prescription medicines, that's not the same thing that killed him at 41 or whatever. If the guy's even dead, we don't know these days. Everybody that's supposed to be dead isn't.
Right.
You know, so I'll just leave that open kind of as a half-witted joke. But there has never been any true will to equip, to train, to hire the forces necessary to keep drugs. And now we've seen, as we've seen over many, many, many years, to keep the illegal immigrants from flooding across the border. But that's changed. And when you have a change like that, you don't keep the same hierarchy in the military, for example. There's a lot of changing out that's going on. Get rid of the, you know, the wokies and the DEI types, because none of that is good. And you know that, and I know that. None of that is good for morale. None of that is good for unit cohesion. None of it's good for an effective force to maintain just the esprit de corps necessary to get the job done. You start taking that out. What I have noticed is Marine Corps billboards everywhere popping up now.
To join the Marines?
To join the Marines. And I think, you know, you have two factors that are going into that. The economy has been such that a lot of young people are saying, yeah, that's something I was thinking of doing before. Now I'm going to do it. And especially since Trump's back in office, now I'm going to do it. And so, again, the preparation that is going into every facet, from the reversing of and countering of social engineering to money to, meaning what the cartels do once that, and where those funds really go and what they do prop up and do not prop up. Chances are with what's wasted in government, we could make up for that ourselves and we wouldn't have to worry so much, even though mapping where that money is going is crucial and absolutely necessary, because you're going to want to be able to confiscate it at the same time. That's part of it. You don't just take them down and let the power vacuum fill. No, you take them down, you confiscate every dime associated with them, whether that hurts Mexico or not. Mexico has no one to blame over the years but themselves for going along with the same agenda. Now, they might have felt that a lot of them had a position of comfort to do that, because they knew quietly that it was part of an agenda that was being supported by dipshits in this country. In the political, in the business, and in every realm.
Speaking of that, you know, I was really thinking about this, and you know, there are so many politicians here that are on the cartel payroll that, hey, maybe just maybe, that is one way that if a politician is proven to be on the payroll of the cartel, that is one that, they're going to get taken away and hauled off to prison, because they're, you know, basically consorting with the enemy. Those seats are going to be wide open for to be filled with special elections. And, you know, that could be a very rapid way of turning over the government as over and, you know, to people that are, you know, that are now paying attention to what's going on.
Responsible in what they're
doing. Right. Exactly. So, I mean, you know, how quickly would you be able to turn around California if, you know, I've heard around me that the cartel is everywhere. And I mean, everywhere. And cartels are, you know, a lot of people say the cartels are in bed with the Chinese, and that may very well be true.
That's true to an aspect.
But the cartels are the foot soldiers of the intelligence agencies. They're the ones that do all the dirty work for the intelligence agencies.
Well,
in a gang fashion.
I know the intelligence agencies are not the ones sitting there with at the complete helm. These people are in business for themselves. Are they? Okay. Have they worked together over the years? Of course. Why? Yeah, yeah. It was because it was part of the agenda.
Right.
So,
and that's maybe a better way to say it. I made it appear, but
yeah. I mean, you know, no, they're not. They're not 100% by any stretch behind it or in the driver's seat for the most part with what they're doing. A lot of these cartels are funded and fronted with massive amounts of fentanyl that comes at a high price from the Chinese. And then they're turned against each other. All kinds of games are going on now that make this a very complex situation. No one is saying it's going to be easy.
Do you know what the
it's going to be straightforward. It's going to be quite an endeavor, to be honest.
You know what's going on here in Southern California is so the cartels they don't really care about marijuana anymore. So the Chinese that are coming over here are they are now getting involved in the marijuana business, and the cartels are giving them the marijuana business. And the price that they're paying is to ensure that they get all the ingredients that they need to make the fentanyl brought in, and know how to do it and how to do it right. So the cartels are trading the fentanyl, or they're trading their rights away to the illegal marijuana market for the ingredients and the know-how to put together the fentanyl.
Yeah, well, a lot of it's not, again, this that kind of substance, to be as potent as it is in such small amounts in micrograms, you're not talking about an awful lot of laboratories down there making it.
Mm-mm.
They won't be making it nearly to the potency that a pharmaceutical factory would. So nobody's kidding anybody. It's known where a lot of that's coming from and what specific manufacturing plants. Again, Wuhan would come up in that. But no one is saying it's an easy endeavor. No one is saying that, we're ready to go. Just throw special. No, you'd be throwing special forces into a shitstorm where they need aerial, sea, and other land assets backing them up. And they would have that. And if people start getting stupid in this country who've crossed the border, that's the whole idea of clearing out the criminals first. Because the average person that crossed that border, or average family, didn't cross it to defend drug dealing. And they know very well, anybody with an ounce of common sense would know,
right,
if that's going to be the cost of what happens in Mexico to clean it up, then so be it. Do these people and families have any intentions of ever going back? Probably not. But if they did, it would be better to go back to a country that's a lot less ravaged by the insanity of these cartels and the brutality of them than it would be to going, you want to go back to a nicer place if your intentions are one day to go back. A lot of them that cross simply come here to work. That's why there's a lot of males. And what they do is they send their money home, because that money, that $100 here, turns into $1,000 down there.
And easily.
A few, a half dozen years of really hard work, sending every dime you didn't absolutely need to eat and sustain yourself off of, you can go back to Mexico and live quite a comfortable life.
Mm-hmm.
This is known. So there's again, a million shades of gray, and a lot of people make statements and respond on a very few of the myriad of points that are involved in something like this. Nobody's going into this half-witted and half thought out. Believe me, and I know, the military does not commit assets until it has covered every potential scenario that's within their power to create in their minds to account for. And again, you have tools like AI that are being used for such things, so you're getting scenarios that no one is even thinking of, but that are potential. Because if we're using it on an everyday level, so are they down there. Also, right, utilizing it to see how they can counter what military forces would do, not just special forces, by far, military forces would do. So, yes, I agree that there should be an obvious strengthening of border law enforcement, and let's say, interdiction and counterintelligence work against these cartels here in the States, you don't have to stick to the border. It's everywhere. It's in counties in Kentucky. It's in counties in Wyoming. And unfortunately, you have a lot in American law enforcement who are know all about it, can't do anything, or know all about it and are part of it. So
right.
There's a whole lot to be looked at and cleaned up in the interim. And this is where the tool of AI becomes something of an asset. Not something of an asset, a very valuable asset, because just by examining spending patterns and behavior of average people in average positions down to the county level, you'll be able to identify at least with a high probability where this is going on. It's happened in Florida for forever, since the 60s and 70s. You've had police helicopters ferrying the shit in various states. They know this is going on. They're doing it. So it's not that I'm coming down on law enforcement. Good people in law enforcement know exactly what I'm referring to. And the majority of them are good people. They want nothing to do with it. And unfortunately, they may see it, but there's nothing they can do. And when this, you know, these gentlemen are talking about, you know, them taking revenge on American families. Okay, do that. Do that once. And then, yeah, Mr. Cartel Leader, you and your beloved family and your mistresses and your children that your wife doesn't know about or does, whatever the case, who cares? Who really gives a shit? But all of you will die. Mm-hmm. That's how you deal with that aspect. If you're going to bring civilians into it and kill families or kidnap families, we're going to destroy yours and extended and your mistress's pets. Everything you know, love, and care about will be destroyed. And we don't need special forces for even that. Hit them from the air. Mm-hmm. But you do need special forces, obviously, for
on the ground, yeah.
On the ground.
Boots on the ground.
And that's not to take anything away from special forces, but it's to say, no, you don't throw these guys out there just willy-nilly without a lot of preparation in every sector where this scourge affects, and it affects almost everything. But shall we just sit back and allow 200,000, 100 to 200 plus die every year because of this poison crossing the border?
Mm-mm.
What are those lives worth?
Right.
I think they're worth any and all combined efforts to stop this nonsense once and for all. Again, it was never a matter of, well, it's too overwhelming and the American public, you know, wants it, so they're going to get it. No. But again, the political and absolute will to stop it was never there via the globalist agenda. And I'll leave it at that.
I agree. Well, I, you know, we covered a lot tonight. I was let's break this off at about here in just a minute or two. I'm kind of tired. Didn't sleep very much last night. And I know you said you've had a long day, but I, you know, getting to hear the Trump and Malay slapping the hell out of all the Marxist bastards at the European Union. Or in Davos, that was just absolute glorious. So, but on that note, I know you're tired and I'm tired and I got a long day tomorrow. So, why don't we just call it a night, and then we can pick this up next week. I'm sure there will be no shortage of things to talk about too. There's only been Trump only did more in 4 days than Biden did in 4 years.
That entire gaggle did in 4 years. You know?
Exactly. It's been a beautiful, it's a very beautiful thing. Very beautiful thing. So, but
is.
Yes, show enough is. But I mean, I hear it in your voice that you're tired, and I'm, like I said, I'm tired myself. So, let's go ahead and call it a night. And I know you and I'll talk this week. Yeah. So, go get some rest. And thank you everybody for tuning in. We had a pretty nice size audience tonight. We were up to about, I think I saw it. We were almost up at 600. So. That's actually a pretty good number. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in. And thank you, Ghost, for your time tonight. And look forward to seeing you next week. And you and I will obviously be talking sooner rather than later. Got things to discuss this week. So yeah. So anyway. All right, everybody. Enjoy your evening. And we will see you next week.
Thank you all, and God bless.
Have a good night, everybody. God bless.